Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the ADA Case Law Update Conference Call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require operator assistance during the program, please press star then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, today's conference is being recorded. I would now like to introduce host today's conference call, Ms. Claudia Diaz. You may begin, ma'am.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Claudia Diaz, and I'll be moderating today's session. Before we get started, I just want to go over a couple of the webinar features. You may have noticed this is a new webinar platform. If you look on the left side, you'll see a couple of boxes, one labeled audio-visual, one labeled participants, and one labeled chat. Each of them has a particular little drop arrow on the right side with lines to it. That's a menu option. You can go ahead and select that and see what features you have available to you. In the audio video box, if you look to the right side, you'll see a closed captioning icon, which is the CC icon. You can click on that if you are interested in using the captioning service at this time, or you can do the keyboard command of Control F. I also want to remind people to hold your question until the designated question and answer portion of today's webinar. We do have the chat area available, so you can put your questions in there during that designated time. And we will also be taking questions through the telephone as well. One last thing I would like us to ask our participants is to refrain from using the emotion icons, as they can be distracting. Today's presentation is the ADA Case Law Update, and it's being presented by Barry Taylor and Alan Goldstein from Equip for Equality. Equip for Equality is the legal advocacy center here in Illinois, and they have been with us for a number of years. At this time, I would like to pass it over to Barry and Alan for today's session. Alan, go ahead.
Hi, this is Alan. Thank you, Claudia. So Barry and I are going to be doing this session today. I'm going to be covering the first half, which will be covering ADA Title I, and then Barry will cover the second half, which will be Titles II and III. Any Illinois attorneys joining us today are eligible for CLE credit. As slide 4 indicates, and you just need to send an email to Barry Taylor, and his address is there, barryt@equipforequality.org. We'll repeat this slide at the end. Excuse me, so here are the Title I issues we're going to discuss today that I'll be covering. We'll talk briefly about the ADA Amendments Act and look at some new cases there. We'll look at some reasonable accommodation cases, cases covering qualified issues or essential job function issues, cases on medical inquiries and examinations, disability harassment, and then the ADA Supreme Court case of 2012, Lozana Tabor with the ministerial exception, which we'll explain as well. For the second half to be covered by Barry, we're going to discuss Titles II and III, and the issues here are listed on slide 6. They'll be education, professional licensing, public services, community integration, criminal justice, transportation, voting, public accommodation access, and standing to sue. So as you can see, we do have a lot of topics we're going to cover. Today's audio conference is really, we want to hit a lot of cases and kind of give a broad overview, just touching on all the cases. For people who want more in-depth analysis of some of the cases, I urge you to look at the Great Lakes ADA Center's webinars that Barry Taylor will also be participating in for the upcoming year, and you can get more in depth on those cases. So the first topic will be recent litigation under the ADA Amendments Act. And just so people are clear, the ADA Amendments Act really only goes to the definition of disability. The provisions regarding reasonable accommodations and the other non-discrimination provisions stay the same. And so that's the changes that have been brought by the ADA Amendments Act. So what we've been seeing since the Amendments Act went into effect on January 1st of 2009 is that courts are following congressional intent this time around, which was that the definition of disability should be interpreted liberally to ensure maximum coverage, and that's what the courts are doing. In the state of Murray, the court allowed the case to continue, although there was a sparse record regarding the client's depression condition. But because the ADAAA commands courts to interpret the definition of disability broadly, the court allowed the case to proceed. In the Kravitz case on the bottom of slide 8, the court again looked at congressional intent, that the focus in ADA cases should be on whether the covered entities have complied with their obligations, and the fact whether or not an individual's impairment is a disability under the ADA should not demand extensive analysis. In the Allen case, this is the court going the other way, but one of the few cases where a person was found not to be disabled under the ADA. And I think part of the issue here is that the person was using the substantial life activity of working, saying they were substantially limited in the major life activity of working, which is generally one of the tougher major life activities to proceed under. So if you can get it under either the major bodily functions under the ADA Amendments Act, such as, you know, cell function or brain function, or you can get a case under one of the other major life activities, working should be avoided unless it's the only major life activity applicable. And we see why in this case, where the court rejected the plaintiff's argument that she was substantially limited in working under the ADA, because her migraines did not substantially limit her in a class or broad range of jobs. This is the same language that was in the ADA before it was amended regarding looking at a person's ability to work in a class or broad range of jobs. The EEOC had looked at changing that language, but they did not. And the court went on to say that the argument concerning the impact of her migraine headaches and the impact of the headaches on sleeping was not developed below, and it was mentioned only in passing an appeal, so the court refused to consider it. I think that's a warning to plaintiffs to make sure that they put in all the evidence about disability necessary. And the court also went on to say that the evidence shows the migraines, even when active and when treated with medication, did not permit her to perform the activities to care for herself in the evenings and compelled her to go to sleep instead, but the court felt this point was too conclusory. And again, I think the plaintiff might have done themselves a better service by introducing more evidence in this case. And that's our tip. It's safest to provide as much specific information as possible on how the impairment substantially limits the major life activity. Looking at the next issue, remember, it has to be a physical or mental impairment that substantially limits a major life activity. We can look at the second component, the substantial limitation in these two cases. On slide 10, in the Eldridge case, the court said that a plaintiff with permanent progressive eye disease that caused a small blind spot negatively impacted her central visual acuity, and therefore the plaintiff was substantially limited in seeing. And in the Barlow case, the court found that the plaintiff with musculoskeletal impairment was covered under the ADA Amendments Act because, quote, an impairment need not prevent or significantly or severely restrict the individual from performing a major life activity in order to be considered substantially limiting. Again, the more liberal definition of substantially limiting under the Amendments Act will work in favor of the plaintiff here. Slide 11, we looked at episodic impairment. Prior to the Amendments Act, it was very difficult for people with episodic impairments to show that they were protected under the ADA. And the ADA was amended. This was remedied because Congress now says you look at episodic impairments when active. And if an episodic impairment substantially limits a major life activity when active, then it will be a disability under the ADA. So in the Molina case, the court found that the back impairment was a disability, where the pain is variable, and would be covered under the ADA Amendments Act if it was substantially limiting when active. And in the Katz case, a job applicant was not hired after identifying herself as a breast cancer survivor. The court finds that after the ADA Amendments Act, it does not matter that the cancer was in remission at the time of the alleged discrimination. When the cancer was active, the court went on and was substantially limiting. In slide 12, the Amendments Act also changed drastically the regarded as prong of the ADA, where employees no longer need to show that an employer regarded them as being substantially limited in a major life activity. And that's what the Wells case said, that the plaintiff is no longer required to prove that the employer regarded her impairment as substantially limiting a major life activity. A person just needs to show that the employer took some adverse employment action based on a perceived or actual impairment. And in the Doobie case, or Doob, I'm not quite sure, the court, and I quote, the defendant relies upon cases applying a much more narrow, a much narrower pre-ADAA definition of regarding as disabled, which are not relevant. And actually, then in some cases I work on as well, where defendants write a brief saying there's not a disability, but they are looking at case law pre-ADA Amendments Act, which I think is no longer applicable. And I think most of the courts see it that way as well. Moving on from the Amendments Act, we're going to look at recent litigation on reasonable accommodation. Always an area where there are lots of issues, and I think we're both employers and employees can better learn their rights and obligations in this area. So in the Cox case, an employee sought reasonable accommodations for returning from leave following an injury at work. And we're going to see a bunch of situations where there are issues with people coming back from leave. A lot of ADA issues come into play. Walmart rejected the person's request for accommodations because she did not file the correct form, but Walmart did not advise her of the error. Walmart also refused to extend the 5-day deadline for submitting paperwork when the employee actually had a good excuse because they were responding to a court subpoena. And the court said that these actions by Walmart could lead a reasonable jury to find that Walmart failed to engage in the interactive process in good faith. And again, that's a very important consideration, is that both sides need to engage in the interactive process. Some more cases in the interactive process in Valdez, an employee with cancer alleged the employer failed to engage in the interactive process when they requested additional leave. Then the court said, in light of his diagnosis with colon cancer, his frequent absences, and his inability to return to work, according to an earlier physician's note, it was uncertain that the employee would be able to return to work on the date proposed in the request for additional leave. And the person found, or the court found, a favorable employer, as under the ADA, an employer is not required to engage an employee in the futile interactive process. Employees still need to show that any accommodation they seek, including leave, will enable them to become qualified. So an employee needs to try to specify a definite period of leave where it's reasonably foreseeable they'd be able to return to work. And in this case, the Valdez case, the evidence does not support the fact that the employee would be able to return to work within a reasonable time. And in the Fisher case, the other thing to keep in mind is that an employer's refusing to engage in the interactive process does not mean the employee automatically wins their case. The employee still needs to show that they would have found a reasonable accommodation if the employer did engage in the interactive process. And that was the holding in the Fisher case at the bottom of the slide, where the employee failed to show that even if the employer engaged in an interactive process, that there was an effective, reasonable accommodation that would have been arrived at. A big case came down in the Seventh Circuit, in EEOC versus United Airlines. And this case stems from the Supreme Court's decision back in 2002 in U.S. Airways v. Barnett, where the court held that if an employer has a reassignment policy whereby reassignment is given to employees based on seniority, then an employer would not have to deviate from that policy to place someone in a position under the ADA, as long as the employer consistently followed that reassignment policy. But the issue that come up then in reassignment is that being an individual with a disability who's no longer able to do their old job is automatically placed in a position that's vacant and that they're qualified for? Or does it mean the employee has the ability to apply for that position? Employers argue that if a person's automatically placed in a position, they might not be the most qualified candidate, and that would be akin to affirmative action, because an employer is required to put someone in a position who might not be the most qualified. On the other hand, employees argue that if a person with a disability is only allowed to compete with a position and is not given that position, then that's not really a reasonable accommodation because anyone from the public can apply for that job. And there's a split in the circuits what reassignment means. But looking at the EEOC versus United case, United had the policy that employees with disabilities who could no longer do the essential functions of their current jobs could only compete for open positions as a reasonable accommodation, but were not entitled to be placed. In the old case law in the Seventh Circuit, under a case EEOC versus Humiston Keeling, I held that the person only gets to compete for the job. They don't get placed immediately in the position. In the EEOC versus United Airlines case, the EEOC took the, I think, incredibly smart and wise step of asking the Seventh Circuit en banc with all the appellate court judges to reconsider the Humiston Keeling case, the Seventh Circuit precedent on reassignment. And as a result, the court overruled Humiston Keeling and held that the ADA mandates that an employer appoint employees with disabilities to vacant positions for which they are qualified, provided that such accommodations would be ordinarily reasonable and would not present an undue hardship. So that means now in the Seventh Circuit, if someone is entitled to reassignment as a reasonable accommodation, they get that vacant position, not just the right to compete for the position. So the split now is the 10th Circuit, the D.C. Circuit, and now the 7th Circuit have held that people get placed immediately in the position. Only the 8th Circuit has held that people only get a right to compete for vacant positions. But the 8th Circuit had based their decision on the Humus and Kalin case from the 7th Circuit that this case, United Airlines, overruled. So the issue is the 8th Circuit going to change their position, in which case you would have unanimity among circuit courts that have decided the issue and give people the right to immediately be placed in vacant positions. So that's that case. Hopefully I explained that clearly. The bottom line is in the 7th Circuit now and in 3 out of 4 circuits that decided the case, employees seeking reassignment can be placed into vacant positions they're qualified for rather than just competing for those positions. Next slide is slide 17, the Sanchez case. This employee sustained brain damage. They had a traumatic brain injury after a fall at work. She requested transfer to a location where she could obtain better medical treatment. Which is a somewhat unusual basis for seeking an accommodation. And in this case, the employer denied the request, arguing that a transfer is not required when the employee can perform her current job's essential functions. And the appellate court ruled in favor of the employee. They said a transfer accommodation for medical care treatment is not per se unreasonable, even if an employee is able to perform the essential functions of her current job without the transfer. And they analyzed the case to the EEOC's interpretive regulations, and the court's own decision that saying a leave of absence can be a reasonable accommodation for people. And they saw the transfer as being a similar type a reasonable accommodation because it's facilitating medical treatment. The next case we have is another case from the Seventh Circuit, Miller versus Illinois Department of Transportation. And one issue we see post-ADA amendments is our essential functions issues. Because an employee needs to be qualified with or without a reasonable accommodation, they need to be able to perform their job's essential function. But then the question comes up, if there's a crew or a group of people who perform functions, does each individual on that crew need to perform every job function of the crew, or can the crew divide up some of the job functions so that some employees perform some functions and some employees perform others? And in this case, the plaintiff, a highway maintainer on a bridge crew, alleged that his employer refused his request not to work at high heights, part of the redundancy, in exposed positions as a reasonable accommodation for his acrophobia. So he had acrophobia. He said he was able to do the other work of a bridge crew, but not working at extreme heights. The accommodation request was denied, as they said he had to perform every function for highway maintainers, but the court held that the plaintiff's case can proceed. And the evidence demonstrated that the employer had informally provided the requested accommodation anyway, as it allowed other crew members to perform non-essential tasks when plaintiffs cannot do so. And even beyond that, the court said, and I'll quote here, that the bridge crew worked as a team. No one person was assigned permanently to any one task. Although individual members of the team did various tasks as needed, there was no requirement that the bridge crew members rotate from task to task in an organized, routine fashion, assessment that was necessary for any one crew member of the bridge crew to be able to do every task of the bridge crew as a whole. And in this case, Mr. Miller presented strong evidence. Clinic knowledge of the city presented evidence that the team accommodated the various skills, abilities, and limitations of the individual team members by organizing itself according to those skills, abilities, and limitations. One person on the team could not weld, so the other members did the welding when required. Another co-worker would not ride in the snooper bucket, so those tasks went to others when needed. And the same thing applied to the tasks of bridge spraying, yard mowing, and debris raking for a crew member with allergies. So the course said the fact that some members of the bridge crew had to be able to work at height, does that mean that each member of the bridge crew needed to be work at heights? And I think this is important in a lot of work settings, not just for people working on highway bridge crews. For example, in grocery and drug stores, we had a case for a cashier who worked in the camera counter, and one of the extra job duties was they had to walk throughout the store to put things on shelves, which our client was not able to do due to her multiple sclerosis. And we argued that other staff could do that function. She was in the camera counter. She could do work around the camera counter, which was required of her. And that because there was a team on duty, other staff could do the work throughout the store. And we ended up being able to resolve that case, but we looked to the Miller case here for support in arguing that. So I think this case is very important and gives plaintiffs a strong argument to make when looking at job duties of a team. Moving on to slide 19 in the Johnson case, a teacher sought an accommodation of being permitted to teach despite not having a current teaching certificate. And the court held that an employer does not have to give a reasonable accommodation to allow an employee to meet the job prerequisites, the qualification standards. That's something an employee needs to meet in order just to be eligible for the job. So waiving that certificate was not a reasonable accommodation. And now we're going to look some more at some qualified essential function issues. In the Feldman case, a plaintiff with fibromyalgia and sleep apnea sought reasonable accommodation of working a day shift and not having to rotate shifts to work overtime. And the court found in favor of the plaintiff that there were triable questions of fact as to whether the plaintiff was disabled under the ADA. As the plaintiff presented medical testimony, demonstrating the gravity of his sleep apnea and why it required a change in his work schedule. The court also found the existence of a triable question of fact as to whether working overtime and rotating shifts were essential functions of the plaintiff's current job or of any job to which plaintiff sought transfer. So sometimes things like overtime when needed are put in the job description, but the reality is that the overtime is needed once every couple of years. And courts sometimes find that even if it's in the job description, that might not be essential if it wasn't an actual function that was consistently performed. So the courts do look at the facts on the ground. In another case, looking at the rotating shift the employee's resource coordinator with diabetes, that was their position, was the employee resource coordinator. They had diabetes and sought a reasonable accommodation of not working rotating shifts. The employer argued that they needed to have rotating shifts because it enabled the employer to provide 24/7 coverage. And the court sided with the employer, finding that working rotating shifts is an essential function of the resource coordinator position. The plaintiff pointed to other facilities that permitted employees to not have to work rotating shifts, of those facilities provided different services, but the court felt that wasn't relevant. And the undue hardship in this case was not a financial hardship. It was an administrative hardship. Remember, undue hardships denied as significant difficulty or expense. So an administrative hardship would be seen as a significant difficulty portion of that definition. And the court here found that the accommodation would require other employees to work more night and weekend shifts, which may not be reasonable if it causes complaints and affects morale. Although I do believe there is some EEOC guidance to the fact that the morale of other employees without disabilities is not a basis for denying a reasonable accommodation. But here the court thought that there would be that administrative difficulty which makes the sought accommodation an undue hardship. In the Rosenbrough case, the employee was born without a hand and was trained to be a school bus driver. They did not need to have a commercial driver's license, a CDL, to drive a school bus. Although part of the training for the school bus driver was to schedule the employee for a CDL exam, the employer refused to schedule her and made derogatory remarks. But the district court held the employee cannot proceed with their case that the lack of a CDL meant they were not qualified to be a bus driver, even though the CDL requirement fit into the training was not actually required of school bus drivers. However, the Court of Appeals reversed the district court, finding that there can be no logical basis for requiring her to have a CDL to be otherwise qualified for the position of trying to obtain a CDL. It's pretty much a catch-22 situation. Not having a CDL was not necessary for the employee to perform the essential functions of her training position. And now we're going to look at recent litigation on medical inquiries and examinations. And if you may remember, the EEOC divides employment into three stages for medical information to be sought by employees, or what's to be sought by employers, excuse me. Pre-employment, employers may seek no medical information, zero, zilch, bupkis, nada, no information. After extending a conditional loss of employment, employers can get medical information if they obtain the information from everyone applying for that position. But they can only exclude someone from that position and withdraw their conditional offer of employment if the reason for doing so is job-related and consistent with business necessity. So it needs to show a person is unable to perform functions or unsafe. But once an employee is on the job and is sitting an employee, an employer can only get more medical information if there's a reasonable basis to do so. So in the Kroll case, a sitting employee was required to obtain and pay for psychological excuse me. I have a little tickle in my throat. The employee was required to obtain and pay for psychological counseling. They refused to do so and were fired. They claimed that counseling is a medical examination of the ADA and that the termination was in retaliation for her refusal to undergo counseling. The district court held that psychological counseling is not a medical exam and therefore that the ADA did not apply, but that was reversed by the Sixth Circuit, which held that mandated counseling could be seen as an attempt to uncover mental health defects, their words, not mine, and therefore it is a medical examination. The employer can still show the medical examination is job-related and consistent with business necessity and therefore lawful, but they would have to make that showing in order to be victorious. Slide 26, the Seth case. I'm an employee brought a class action by alleging the county's wellness program violated the ADA by requiring participating employees to undergo medical exams and answer certain medical inquiries. Employees who did not participate were charged a penalty of $20 a week. The information gathered from the exams and questionnaire were used to identify employees who had one of five diseases. And in the case was, I have to confess, I find a little surprising. The court held that this did not violate the ADA. They went to the safe harbor provision of the ADA, which allows for wellness programs that are terms of the group health plan to be protected from violation. So because this wellness program was a term of the group health plan, the court held it fell under the ADA safe harbor provision, and then therefore charging the employees the $20 a week was acceptable. For people not living in the Seventh Circuit, I could easily see a court deciding the other way on this issue. So I have a feeling this might not be the last word on wellness programs, but this is the recent case on it, and I'm in favor of the employer. And then we have an announcement here on a settlement. The DOJ looks closely at medical inquiries, and while the confidentiality mostly is under Title I, the DOJ does get involved in some situations. Here it was an employment situation that involved police officers, firefighters, EMTs, and civilian employees who were subject to inappropriate and intrusive medical exams and other discrimination, and to resolve that the county had to pay almost $500,000 in damages plus benefits, adopt new policies and procedures, refrain from using the services of the medical examiner who conducted the overbroad examinations in question, cease the automatic exclusion of job applicants who have insulin-dependent diabetes mellitus, and provide ADA training to all current supervisory employees and all employees making personnel decisions. And the ADA training is always key. I think employers can save themselves a lot of ADA situations by making sure their staff's trained. And we have a link on slide 27 to the Department of Justice settlement. And the case looking at medical information direct threat on slide 28, the Sanders case. An employee was required to undergo a medical examination after he supposedly made threats in the workplace. It was later determined that the threats were unfounded, but the employer still required the medical exam. The employee sued into the ADA for an improper medical exam, and the employer raised the direct threat. And the court held that the employee's case can proceed as there was a question of fact whether the business necessity for the examination still existed. And that's because the threats were unfounded. If a person actually did make threats of harm in the workplace, then I think the employer would likely win that case. But here, as there was a factual question to whether the threats actually were made, I think that undercuts the employer's case. And that's what the court held. And now we'll look at harassment, and we have a note there on the bottom of the slide that there is a brief in the Great Lakes ADA Center on harassment, and there's actually a whole list of briefs on a variety of ADA topics. So I encourage people to look at the legal resources on adagreatlakes.org. If you want more information on any of the topics presented today. The legal standard for disability harassment, there are five factors in harassment claims. One, the plaintiff must be a qualified individual with a disability. Two, they must be welcome or subject to unwelcome harassment as opposed to welcome harassment. The harassment must be unwelcome. The harassment must be based on the plaintiff's disability. And this is the fourth condition is the hardest, if the harassment was sufficiently severe or pervasive to alter a term, condition, or privilege of employment. And we see a lot of cases where, even though to many of us the harassment seems severe and pervasive, but courts have found it did not reach the legal standard to constitute ADA harassment. And the fifth factor is that there must be a factual basis to impute liability for the harassment to the employer. That is, the employer knew or should have known of the harassment and failed to take prompt remedial action. The recent case in the Davis versus the Vermont Department of Corrections, prison guard injured his groin and testicles at work. During his recovery leave, his supervisor sent two staff-wide offensive emails containing pictures that referenced the guard's injury. One of the emails contained a picture of an individual with his testicles showing, with the employee, Mr. Davis's face superimposed on the individual. And these emails were seen by staff as well as inmates. Remember, he's a prison guard, a position where, you know, safety of the employees can be paramount. When Mr. Davis returned from leave, he received a note in his mailbox stating, "How's your nuts? Kill yourself, you're done." And despite the scary thing of the note, it actually was not grammatically correct either. He also received an email with a cartoon of a person with a gun to his head captioned, "Kill yourself." And as a result of the emails being spread around, Mr. Davis was ridiculed by prisoners who grabbed their testicles and made comments like, "Good luck making kids with that package." The court said the incidents in this case were sporadic, but here the court found they were severe, and that the conduct could constitute disability harassment. It was perpetuated by his supervisors, and it interfered with an essential function of his job, maintaining orderly control of the prisoners. The court went on to note that prison guards must rely on their co-workers to stay safe, and this was compromised when the plaintiff was ostracized by his co-workers. And furthermore, courts have generally held that prison officials are not responsible for the conduct of inmates. But here, in this case, the inmates would not have known about the guard's disability if his supervisors had not disclosed the injury. And the court compared the situation to an employer tolerating sexual harassment. Some other recent cases of harassment and constructive discharge in the Schwarzkopf case. The court allowed the hostile work environment claim of an employee with depression and anxiety disorder to move forward because the court found he was subject to a significant number of negative comments related to his disability offered in the presence of co-workers. Went on to hold a reasonable jury could find that the adverse treatment he endured was sufficiently severe and pervasive to constitute harassment based on disability. And in the McKelvey case, the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals held that ongoing taunting and derogatory name-calling over a nine-month period of a soldier who lost his hand in battle could amount to a constructive discharge claim. The court also held that reinstatement rather than front pay is the favored equitable remedy for constructive discharge. So what you see here, a few favorable harassment cases, is a signal that maybe harassment is getting easier to prove, and before it had been very, very, very difficult. It might be too early to tell, but at least like the recent cases do show a little bit of a greater understanding about harassment based on disability in the workplace. And now we're going to look at the Supreme Court case on the ADA and what may not be the most known provision of the ADA, the ministerial exception. And in this case, Hosanna Tabor versus the EEOC, the court looked at this exception, and courts have really recognized a ministerial exemption grounded in the First Amendment that precludes the application of non-discrimination and employment laws based on, you know, coming from the Civil Rights Act, to claims concerning relationships between a religious institution and its ministers. And, you know, what the Supreme Court said about this, it is based on the First Amendment, and what the Supreme Court said in the decision is, and I quote, by imposing an unwanted minister, the state infringes the free exercise clause, which protects a religious group's right to shape its own faith and mission through its appointments, according to the state, the power to determine which individuals will minister to the faithful also violates the Establishment Clause, which prohibits government involvement in such ecclesiastical decisions. So the court actually found both prongs of the religious aspect in the First Amendment violated both the Free Exercise Clause and the Establishment Clause. But I want people to think for themselves, if religious organizations are prevented from discriminating based on disability or race, is that really undue government interference with a religious organization? Possibly. But I urge people to think they should do for themselves and think about it. In this case, the employee was a teacher at an elementary school operated by the Lutheran Church. She initially worked as a lay teacher, but then went through a process to become a quote-unquote called teacher. She taught math, language arts, social studies, science, gym, art, and music, and also led a religion class 4 days a week, led students in prayer and devotional exercises each day, attended a weekly school-wide chapel service, and twice a year led the chapel service herself. She then took a medical leave, but when she tried to return, she was told the position was filled and the school did not believe she was ready to return to the classroom. She told the school she had spoken to an attorney and intended to assert her legal rights, and she was terminated soon thereafter. And then the EEOC filed suit on her behalf under the ADA. The district court dismissed the case under the ministerial exception, but the Sixth Circuit reversed, holding that the ministerial exception did not apply because her duties were identical to that of a lay teacher, not necessarily someone of, you know, with a religious type of position. Remember, the ministerial exception only applies to people who are ministering to a congregation. So it wouldn't apply, for example, to an admin assistant or a custodian. It needs to be someone in some position of religious ministering. However, the Supreme Court reversed the Sixth Circuit's holding and said that the employee does fall under the ministerial exception. She underwent specific religious training in a commissioning process. The school held her out as a minister, and her duties reflected the role of conveying the church's message. And I'd say here at Equal for Equality, we had a case also regarding someone who was terminated due to mental health issues, but they were, in fact, a pulpit minister, and we thought the ministerial exception actually protected the church's right to terminate this minister, even though we thought it was very unfortunate they were choosing to do so. And I think with that, that ends the first half of the program. I think I'm going to turn it open for questions, and then Barry will look at titles 2 and 3. Thank you.
Do you want to take questions right now for your half, sir? Is that correct? Peter.
Yeah, Peter. If you can give instructions to participants on how they can add questions to the telephone.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question or a comment at this time, please press star then the 1 key on your touchtone telephone.
And for participants in the webinar platform, you can go ahead and submit your questions in the chat area at this time.
Then we do have one question on the phone line. Did you want to go and take that one?
Yes, please go ahead with the question.
It's from Julia Sang.
Hi, thank you very much. This is enlightening as always. I have a question back on slide 12, talking about the regarded as. Could you tell us the facts in the Doobie case versus Texas Health and Human Services?
Let me try and see if I can find that slide. I think I have to go back to the case to find out what facts particularly you're interested in.
Well, I was just interested because it talked about how the defendant was relying upon a narrower definition, and I wondered which piece of the pre-ADAAA definition the defendant was depending upon.
Well, I think the court's talking about the regarded as part of the definition.
I would be curious about the disability or how it was considered as regarded. I could probably look it up. I just wondered if you had it on the tip of your tongue.
Yeah, I don't have it offhand, but we do have the citation there.
Right. Thank you.
Okay, sure.
I'm not showing any further questions at this time on the phone lines.
Okay, well, this is Barry, and I think what we'll do is we'll move to titles 2 and 3, and if people have questions at the end on any of the things we presented today, you can feel free to ask those, and Alan, if I could indulge and have you move the slides as we go along, I'd appreciate it. So the next topic we're going to move into is recent litigation on the ADA and education, and for those of you who are looking at the PowerPoint, see all the different visuals that Alan has done. We've got John Belushi from Animal House with a big college sweatshirt, so he gets all the credit for these the visuals that are here. So with education, we've got a few cases we wanted to talk about. The first one is the Johnson case, and this is a case that was decided earlier this year involving accommodating a student who had a couple of different disability issues. One was she had a learning disability and had asked for accommodations to participate in a private surgical technician program, so that would be under Title III. And although they had promised to provide some accommodations to her, they had failed to provide those when push came to shove. And then during while she was a student, she became unable to attend classes because she her lung condition that she had made it difficult for her to walk upstairs, and the classes that she was supposed to be attending were on the second floor and only accessible by stairs. And so ultimately, she wasn't able to go, and despite the program director who had recruited her assured her the attendance wouldn't be a problem, the teacher was unsympathetic and she was dismissed from the program for violating the attendance policy. And the teacher here was really unsympathetic, said things along the lines of, well, she can just figure out how to get to class herself. And he was upset that, you know, one student was getting what he called special treatment, that the tail was wagging the dog. So this was a teacher who really just did not believe that people with disabilities should be accommodated. And as a result, she was unable to continue with her classes and filed suit under the ADA. And initially, the plaintiff lost, but when it got up to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, the court reversed the ruling in favor of the Washington County Career Center and found that the plaintiff here had put forth sufficient evidence that the school had failed to provide the accommodations. And they also found that this attendance policy that they had cited for a basis for her dismissal was actually something that they had not been enforcing consistently for students without disabilities. And so if you have a policy that you enforce only against or disproportionately against people with disabilities who are protected, that runs afoul of the ADA. And so by reversing Southern Jenna, that meant that the case would continue on and the plaintiff would have a chance to present her case more fully. And I think this case, for those of you who are involved in the educational system, is a really good example of how a lone teacher's actions can be enough to raise an ADA violation. Here you had an administration who was trying to be supportive of a person with disability, but they unfortunately were very deferential to the teacher, and as a result, the entire educational entity was deemed to be in violation of Title III, or at least the case was continued to see if they were in violation of Title III. Let's move on to the next case, the Argeni case versus Creighton University. This is a really interesting case. It involved a student who had hearing disabilities. The student used a hearing aid, also had a cochlear implant, and had requested a number of accommodations at the medical school, including a CART, which, if those of you aren't familiar with that, is communication access, real-time transcription, so captioning, sort of as it goes along, and also interpreters from the medical school. And the student had received these same accommodations as an undergrad at a different university in Seattle. And the school did provide some accommodations here. They provided note takers, front row seating, electronic version of materials, but they did not want to provide or did not agree to provide CART or the interpreters. They said that they did not see that that was necessary given the student's residual hearing through the hearing aid and the cochlear implant. And they did request more information from the student's doctor to clarify the real need for the CART and interpreters given the assistive listening devices that the student had. What was interesting here is that instead of giving that information to the school, the student was sort of fed up and said, look, I'm just gonna do it myself. I'm going to use my own money to pay for CART and interpreters, and I'm going to sue. So Alan's been talking about the interactive process, and I think one of the mistakes here for the plaintiff here, who obviously was very frustrated, but still did not give the information that had been requested that may have ended up being the student's downfall here. Interestingly, after the suit was filed, the school did agree to provide the interpreters for the larger classes, but not for the small ones. And they denied also the student the opportunity of providing his own interpreter for the smaller classes, even though he was willing to pay for them. The school took the position that it would be better for the student to be prepared for his profession as a physician if he was involved in clinics without interpreters, and they believed that he could do it without interpreters. So what ended up happening was the court did find in favor of the university, saying that the accommodations that were provided were sufficient. And during the pendency of this litigation, the plaintiff actually filed a motion to allow the use of his own interpreters, and the court found that that was not something that they were going to force the university to allow happen. And they looked at the fact that the student already passed classes without interpreters. And so that it sort of undercut the plaintiff's argument that the interpreters were needed. Now, passing classes versus doing only well in classes, I think, could be a difference here, and we'll talk about that a little bit more. But basically, I think the bottom line here was the court found that the university had provided effective communication, and that was required, not necessarily the preferred accommodation. And what had happened here, the doctor only said that the CART and the interpreters would benefit or be appropriate for the plaintiff. The doctor did not say that they were imperative or were necessary. And so I think what the court suggests here is that you have to provide an accommodation only if the plaintiff shows it's necessary to provide access to the public accommodation. At least that's the position that this particular court took. So I think the instruction here for plaintiffs is that you should make sure you engage in the interactive process give the information that's requested, and also the doctor's note should be very clear how imperative and necessary the requested accommodations are. Let's move to another case. And this is an interesting settlement that the Department of Justice entered into recently. This is a case that was brought actually by the AIDS Law Project of Pennsylvania, and then the Department of Justice opened an investigation once the case was filed. This was a school, a high school called Milton Hershey School, that refused to enroll a student simply because he was HIV positive. And some of the language in this case was really disheartening to hear in 2012, where they said, you know, we don't take kids like that, and that we don't have the needs, we don't have the means to provide support for students with HIV. Some real, you know, reactionary type of statements that were made here. This was a student who really had no manifestations of his HIV except that he had to take some meds during the day, and that was it. So a complete overreaction, this denial. And so the suit, after it was filed, the student ultimately elected not to attend the school, but the case resulted in the school paying $700,000 in damages under the law to as part of the settlement. And this is, you may have even read about this in the paper, there was a big, because of the name Hershey involved, and that was paid for by the Hershey Company, the school was paid for the Hershey Company, there was big protest in Times Square at the Hershey store. So this got a lot of press involved. And basically, what after the suit was filed, the school had claimed that the student would be a direct threat in the workplace, and the plaintiff put on strong evidence that there was no significant risk for a student with HIV in school to transmit HIV. And so after, I think, the evidence that was put forth, the settlement came forward. And in addition to the monetary settlement, the school adopted a non-discrimination policy, and training was required of the staff and administration. If you're interested in more information on this, we've got a link on this slide for the settlement. And DOJ also has a specific fact sheet at ada.gov/AIDS that has a fact sheet on discrimination against people with HIV and AIDS. But I think this case is a good example. We sometimes hear about direct threat in the Title I case involving employment, but that it can also arise in the Title III case and Title II scenario as well within the education context. So let's move on to our next topic, which is litigation involving professional licensing. And the first case we're going to talk about is the INYARC case. And those of you who participated in this audio conference last fall might remember we actually talked about this case, but there have been some developments in the case since then, and because I think it's such an important case, we wanted to give you an update and bring people up to speed who weren't on the call last year. So the INYARC case is a case that was brought against the National Conference of Bar Examiners, and in this case you had a law school graduate who was legally blind, and the State Bar Association had agreed to let him use a laptop with assistive technology, JAWS and Zoom Text. But the National Bar Examiners, which oversees these exams, had refused to allow him to have this text for the part of the examination that they oversee. And he had been granted some testing accommodations, including extra time, hourly breaks, a private room, but not the laptop with the assistive technology. And so ultimately this got up to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and they affirmed the lower court decision that he should be allowed to use the technology in the laptop. And what they were saying was that the previously granted accommodations didn't make the exam accessible to the plaintiff and did not provide effective communication. So they, what they looked at was the fact that he had received other accommodations in the past, and that had been enough. And if you turn to the next slide, what the court did was they looked at the Title III regulation that is starting to get some play that I think is really important for people, no matter what your role is in the ADA, to look at, because that regulation talks about that the examination must be administered to best ensure, that's the main language here, to best ensure that the examination results accurately reflect the individual's aptitude or achievement level. And a court said if you apply that best ensure standard, the accommodations that were offered to the plaintiff, the ones beyond the laptop with the technology, would not make the exam accessible, because even with the other accommodations, the plaintiff put forth evidence that she would still experience eye fatigue, disorientation, and nausea. And again, the bar examiners tried to point to past success on previous standardized tests that this particular plaintiff had without the assistive technology with the laptop. And the court said that past success really is not indicative of the current situation. And that's really a contrast to the Virginia case that we looked at before, which showed that the student had passed the exams without CART and interpreter. So this shows a different approach to this whole issue. And then I think what's also important in this case is that the plaintiff's disability, the eye and the visual disability, had been progressive. And so they said that testing accommodations should advance as technology progresses. So the fact that you got different accommodations in the past wouldn't necessarily be determinative if your disability is progressing, the manifestations of it are progressing, as well as new advancements in technology. So if you turn to the next slide, what's happened since last time we talked is that the National Conference of Bar Examiners actually asked the Supreme Court to review this, saying that the Ninth Circuit's interpretation of this best ensure standard was incorrect. And the Supreme Court declined to accept the case. And so the decision by the Ninth Circuit stands. And so after that decision, it then went back down to the trial court. And at that point, the trial court found in favor of the plaintiff, found that the plaintiff was entitled to the requested accommodations, and that all the experts that the plaintiff had put forth were not only admissible, but were persuasive to the court. And so the accommodations had to be provided. We don't have time to talk about it today, but this case also has a very in-depth discussion of an undue burden analysis, and that it wasn't an undue burden for the National Conference of Bar Examiners to provide this accommodation. So I would recommend looking at that if you're interested in that issue. I also wanted to point out that we do have an incorrect cite on this slide. In the second bullet point, we have the number 925 for the page number where the case starts. It's actually supposed to be 995. We corrected that for the webinar, but for those of you who downloaded the materials before, it is you might have the wrong number. So it's 995 instead of 925. And then the last licensing case we want to talk to you about is a case involving the Law School Admissions Council. So these are people who are looking to go to law school as opposed to take the bar examination. And this was a case that was brought in California on behalf of people with disabilities in California who had been denied testing accommodations by the Law School Admissions Council for the Law School Admissions Test, or the LSAT. And just last month, in October, Department of Justice was allowed to intervene in this case. And so this case goes from being just covering people in California to now being a nationwide case, a nationwide pattern or practice lawsuit. So the Department of Justice is saying what the Law School Admissions Council is doing is something they're doing on a nationwide basis. And they have allegations that talk about the LSAC systemically failing to provide testing accommodations And again, they say these accommodations are ones that best ensure that the test taker will be able to demonstrate their aptitude. So again, that best ensure standard that we talked about before comes in play. And they said there's just replete with the record of discriminatory policies that are denying accommodation requests, even for people who've had a strong history of accommodations. Some people even having accommodations since elementary school that are being denied accommodations on the LSAT. The other component in this case that's very interesting is that the LSAC is flagging test scores for people who are receiving testing accommodations, and that results in certain test takers with disabilities being identified for the law schools that they have received accommodations and therefore that they do have disabilities. And so the Department of Justice is saying that this is an unlawful disclosure of a person's disability through this flagging. So this case is just progressing. DOJ has just joined it. So this is one that we'll want to watch to see what happens if it gets litigated or if a settlement is reached. Let's move on to the next topic, which is recent litigation on the ADA and public services. And we've got one case we just want to quickly let you be aware of. You may have seen this in the press as well because of the facts involved. And this is something about medical marijuana and the ADA. And in this case, you had plaintiffs who had disabilities and their doctors had prescribed marijuana for their pain. I believe they had cancer. And there were state laws involved in California that allowed the use of medicinal marijuana, but federal laws didn't. And so two cities where the plaintiffs resided looked to shut down the collectives that were distributing the medical marijuana. And so in response, the plaintiffs filed suit under Title II of the ADA. And as people might remember, the ADA does exclude from the definition of disability individuals who are engaged in the illegal use of drugs. So the question here is, does the plaintiff's use of medical marijuana constitute the illegal use of drugs under the ADA? And this is a really complicated case, and it would probably take a half hour to go through all the distinctions that are in here. But what I just wanted to point out is that there's a provision in the ADA that talks about that the illegal use of drugs is not covered or it does not apply if the plaintiff can show that the drug is taken under the supervision by a licensed healthcare professional or other uses authorized by the Controlled Substances Act or other provisions of federal law. And the big dispute here, the plaintiff was saying, well, we've got the supervision of the licensed healthcare professional, that should be enough. And what the defendant as well as the court said is, no, it's not just the licensed healthcare professional. You have to also show that the use is authorized by the Federal Controlled Substances Act or other parts, or other provisions of federal law, and that the plaintiffs didn't do that here. And so ultimately they said that the use, because the medical marijuana was federally prohibited, it did not come within the exception for drug use authorized by other provisions of federal law. And the fact that just because the person was supervised by a physician was not enough to get coverage by the ADA. So, I know this is probably going to be an issue that continues to percolate a little bit. I think after the last election, another state, I think it was Colorado, did pass a law allowing for the use of medical marijuana. And so the sort of interplay between the ADA as a federal law and these state laws is going to be something that will be interesting to watch as these progress. We're going to next move to the issue of community integration. And moving to the next slide, people probably are familiar with the Olmstead decision that said that people with disabilities are entitled to receive services in the most integrated setting. And slide 49 has the different factors that are involved on what it takes to show that you're entitled to community integration, that treatment officials find that community is appropriate, the person doesn't oppose placement in the community, and that the placement can be reasonably accommodated, taking into account the state's resources and needs of other people with disabilities. And that third bullet point is really the big part of the litigation. And the states can meet their ADA obligations if they have a comprehensive, effectively working plan for placing people with disabilities in less restrictive settings and a reasonable waiting list that moves at a reasonable pace. So I think the biggest case that came down in community integrations on the next slide is sort of taking the Olmstead decisions to a new level, and that's the Lane versus Kitzhaber case. Hopefully I'm pronouncing that last because it's named correctly. And this is a suit that was filed on behalf of 8 people who had intellectual disabilities, and they were working in segregated workshops, even though they were able and wanted to work in an integrated employment setting, looking for supported employment. And they filed suit under the ADA claiming that the integration mandate applies to not just people who are in institutions or who are at risk of moving into institutions if the state doesn't provide community services, but also claiming that the integration mandate applies to whether employment-related services are in an integrated setting or in a segregated setting like a segregated workshop or a sheltered workshop. It's another term that's used. And the court found in favor of the plaintiff that they did state a valid claim under Title II. And after that decision was reached, the court actually entered another order certifying the case as a class action. So it's no longer on behalf of these 8 individuals, but on behalf of all people in sheltered workshops who are seeking to be in more integrated settings. So this is an example of Olmstead being extended beyond people in institutions or who are at risk of institutionalization because of a lack of community services, those are the cases I think most of us are familiar with, but this is one that is taking it to a different perspective on what community integration really means. So I think we should watch this case carefully. The plaintiff hasn't proven their case yet, but finding that Title II applies and finding that they get a class certified, I think, are two huge hurdles that the plaintiffs have gotten over, and it'll be interesting to see how the litigation progresses from there. We also wanted to let you know about a case, in case you hadn't heard about it, that the Department of Justice brought against the state of Virginia regarding people who are with intellectual disabilities living in state-operated institutions, about 2,900 people. And this is a case where the state ultimately reached an agreement with the Department of Justice, but there was a group representing parents of institutional residents who did oppose the agreement. So there was the agreement was not immediately moved forward because of the disagreement by the institutional residents' parents. But later in the summer, an agreement was approved by the court despite the objections that were raised by the institutional parents. And on the next slide, you'll see the provisions of the agreement, which will allow for 4,200 new home and community-based waivers for adults and children on their waiting list for community services. So this involves not just adults, but kids as well. They're also going to be creating an employment first policy to provide meaningful work opportunities for people with intellectual disabilities. So this corresponds with the Lane case we just talked about for people in segregated employment. Also, the case provides for housing assistance to provide opportunities for people to live independently and also have some comprehensive risk management systems and community crisis systems to help people from being unnecessarily institutionalized who are in the community. Another consent decree that was entered recently was here in Illinois, is the Colbert case that was entered since we talked last fall. The Colbert case was brought by a group of organizations, the ACLU of Illinois, Access Living, Equip for Equality, my organization, as well as a private law firm, S&R Denton, on a pro bono basis. And this was a case that was brought against Illinois state officials on behalf of about 16,000 people with physical disabilities or people with mental illness who are living in traditional nursing homes in Cook County, Illinois, which is where Chicago is located. And after some litigation and some negotiations, an agreement was reached between the plaintiff class and the state. And last December, a comprehensive consent decree was entered by the judge, and that will allow nursing home residents who the opportunity to move in the community and receive the supports that they need to be successful. And the next slide just gives the terms of the consent decree, and I think I'm just going to continue on past this slide. Really have more time to get to the other cases, but it's laid out pretty clearly what the provisions of that agreement are. We also have a monitor that's been appointed, and just this last week, an implementation plan was filed with the court. And then the next slide, we have just a listing of some other settlements that have happened in community integration litigation in California, Florida, North Carolina, and Maine. And if you are interested in more information on these particular cases, one option would be to contact the Protection Advocacy Agency in the relevant state. And if you don't know the Protection Advocacy Agency in your state, that can be found on our National Association's website, which is located at NDRN, for the National Disability Rights Network, NDRN.org. And then there'll be a U.S. map that you can click on to find the information for your PNA state. For these cases, as well as other cases, we obviously can't cover all these or list them all. And there are other Olmstead cases that are either been resolved or that are currently pending in many states across the country. Let's move on to the next topic, though, litigation in the criminal justice realm. And we've got a couple of cases we wanted to point out. One is another settlement. And this was done by the Protection Advocacy Agency in Massachusetts, as well as the Center for Public Representation and Private Law Firm. And this was brought against the Massachusetts Department of Corrections, basically alleging that prisoners with mental illness being in solitary confinement violated the Americans with Disabilities Act, Section 504 of the Rehab Act, as well as the 8th and 14th Amendments of the Constitution. And again, an agreement was reached in that case. You've got a link for the agreement, but basically it's going to be significantly expanding mental health services for prisoners with mental illness, also reducing or removing segregation for them, and also have secure treatment units as alternatives to segregation. So some major systemic change in Massachusetts as a result of this litigation. We also wanted to tell you about the Jaros case, which is one that was decided here in Illinois. And this is a case involving an individual as opposed to the broader systemic litigation in the previous slide. And this is a prisoner who used a cane. He had advanced osteoarthritis as well as vascular necrosis in his hip. And he had filed suit under the ADA, the Rehab Act, and the Eighth Amendment for cruel and unusual punishment because he was unable to access showers and meals, the same as non-disabled prisoners. There were a lack of grab bars and access to toilets as well. It's not listed here, but that was another component. And this was a case where the prison officials, I think, didn't do themselves any favors. They had said, well, you know, you just need to deal with it. And they said that the IDOC had not designated this particular prison as a handicap prison, and so they didn't have to make the accommodations that were requested, which is obviously incorrect. And then he was also denied access to the prisoner's work release program because of his cane use. And again, the prison officials didn't do themselves any favors because they stated that no one with a cane can go on work release as a matter of course. So even though you had a doctor in this particular case who said he was qualified to participate in work release, they had a no assistive device policy. So if you used a wheelchair or a cane, you couldn't be in the work release program, which is a clear discriminatory exclusion. And the court found that the plaintiff should be able to proceed with his claim under the Rehab Act. The Department of Corrections had filed a motion to dismiss, and that the IVC had failed to accommodate his disabilities and his claim for denial of participation in the prison work release program. So on both, he was able to proceed with both of his claims. The court did say that there wasn't an Eighth Amendment violation because the Department of Corrections had not been deliberately indifferent. They had provided him with a cane. They had prescribed some pain meds and given him some a lower bunk preference. And, they didn't deprive him of the shower and toilet access or meal access. It just had made it more difficult. And so it didn't rise to the level of a constitutional violation. But they did say that those he could proceed with his argument under the Rehab Act. We'll now shift over to some transportation litigation and a couple of cases in the New York area. One was a case involving the modification of a train station, and remember under the ADA, when you make modifications to transit entities, facilities, the ADA can kick in. And the district court here had said that when they did modify this train station, it did trigger the accessibility requirements, and they ordered the transit authority to make the station accessible. But the Third Circuit found that these modifications may not be required because the transit authority had shown that it would be technically infeasible potentially to make the changes despite the modifications they had made. There were arguments that it would require them to acquire subterranean property rights and that there were some technical infeasibilities of having to move a load bearing part of the station if they made it accessible, and also whether it would even violate the fire safety code if they made it accessible. So the court said there was enough potential issues as to infeasibility of it that they sent it back to the trial court to look at it in more detail. We also have a case on accessible taxis, and this is the Knoll case. And this is a case that was actually not brought against the taxis themselves, but by a commission that licensed the taxis. And the gist of this case is that the Taxi and Limousine Commission couldn't be covered under Title 2B of the ADA, which covers particular transit entities, because the commission was not a transit provider. And so they tried to be covered under Title 2A for public services, and the court said that's not, it didn't violate that aspect either because Title 2 doesn't require public entities to police the compliance of the private entities it licenses. They only can require that the licensee not be discriminatory in its practices, but not in how it actually implements the license with respect to the people with disabilities. So they said it was too attenuated to make the Limousine Commission liable here. I think that there's that people need to be aware that you could go after the title of the taxi as a private entity, the taxi companies under as a private entity under Title III, although there are exceptions under the ADA with respect to sedans, but the general rule is that they purchase vans, that those vans have to be accessible for people with disabilities. And then we also wanted to make sure you're aware of some recent DOJ settlements involving accessible charter buses, and this highlights four recent settlements, but DOJ has reached agreements with 22 different private bus companies to ensure accessibility for people using private charter buses under Title III. So there's some information on this slide for more information if you want to see that. We also wanted to alert you to, given the recent election, that there was an important ADA case on voting. And this is the United Spinal Association versus Board of Elections in the city of New York. And a couple of different disability groups filed suit under the ADA in Section 504, claiming that the Board of Elections didn't provide meaningful access to people with disabilities. And they had designated a lot of different accessibility problems, missing ramps, broken ramps, inappropriate signage, inappropriate placement of voting equipment, heavy doors, broken doors, and all sorts of things. And in a nutshell, what the defendant here tried to say was, well, they actually got to vote, and so they didn't deprive them of voting, so then they don't have a claim of voting discrimination under the ADA. And the court said, no, that's not the standard of the ADA. The standard is meaningful access. And the defendant did not meet that standard. They did not provide meaningful access because of all these barriers that were in place in polling places. And they did not provide alternatives that would have provided access, like other types of polling places that were accessible. And so therefore, they found a violation of the ADA in that case. We also want to make sure you're aware of recent litigation on public accommodation access. The main case that I think has gotten a lot of press recently is a case against Netflix for failing to provide equal access with its Watch Instantly website. And basically, the argument in this case was Netflix was saying that it wasn't covered by Title III of the ADA because they were not a place of public accommodation. And they said, you know, if you look at the ADA, and they give examples of within the different categories of public accommodation, there's nothing about web-based service. Well, the reason is the ADA was passed in 1990, and we didn't have really know what web-based services were in 1990. That came later in the 90s. And the court said, you know, Congress didn't intend to limit the ADA to the specific examples that were listed in the categories of public accommodations. The other issue that had been raised was saying that the ADA to rule in favor of the plaintiff here would allow the ADA to sort of trump the more recently enacted 21st Century Communications and Video Accessibility Act, which provides for more specific standards regarding captioning. And the court found that they were not inconsistent. And then soon after this case was decided this past summer, the parties reached an agreement, which now Netflix will agree to provide captioning on 100% of its streaming videos within 2 years. We've given you a link to the settlement if you want more information on that. We also have a couple of cases listed here on the next slide regarding access to amusement parks, and they go different ways. The Bauman case said that a person who wanted to use a Segway at Disneyland in California, that Disneyland should have accommodated them and modified their policy preventing the use of two-wheeled vehicles in the park. That was in the digital case. The Alt case was out of Disney World in Florida, and in that case, suit had been brought about Segways, and the people who had brought the suit ultimately settled in saying that they could exclude Segways as long as they had these alternate vehicles called ESVs, which are four-wheeled electric stand-up vehicles, and said that that should be sufficient. And when they reached that agreement, a lot of people didn't think that was a good agreement. The Department of Justice and I think like 23 different attorneys general filed objections saying that the plaintiff's agreement that they had reached here was did not serve the broader disability community appropriately, and eliminating Segways was not should not have been agreed to. And the 11th Circuit upheld the agreement and said that it was a reasonable agreement. And even though there is new DOJ guidance on Segways, they felt that Disney could show that they did have legitimate safety concerns, which is an exception under the guidance that the new regulations that DOJ has put out on Segways. So that settlement was allowed to proceed that prevents use of Segways at Disney properties. We also have a listing of some agreements that are reached with respect to access to movie theaters on the next slide, and we've got the sites and the links there for you if you're more interested, but all those interested in more details. All those are involving access to movie theaters for people who are deaf, blind, or hard of hearing. And one is in Arizona, one is in Texas, and one is here in Illinois that we had worked on with our Illinois Attorney General. So some very far-reaching access agreements that are being reached on respect to access to movie theaters. And then we've also got a couple of recent rulings as opposed to agreements involving access to businesses. One is involves two Hollister stores, which are funded by Abercrombie and Fitch, with respect to physical access, and these particular stores were not accessible. Their main entrance wasn't accessible, but there were other parts of the store, other entrances that were, and so the dispute was whether or not the main entrance had to be accessible, and the court found that it was, even though the store was had compliance with some of the precise design standards on the ADA. They did not really encompass the broader policy views of the ADA in making the main entrance inaccessible, and so they lost on that case. And the Mueller versus Taco Bell case is a case involving 160 Taco Bell restaurants in California that had a number of design inaccessibility problems, and the court found in favor of the plaintiffs there and ruling that Taco Bell would have to make some changes to how they are their design of their stores in California. And then the last thing we wanted to share with you were just a few news suits regarding standing to sue. You might remember, if you participated in these calls before, that sometimes people have a hard time proving that they can be a plaintiff in a case involving access to private businesses under Title III or to public entities under Title II, because they can't show that they have standing. And usually the case revolves around whether they are likely to show future harm, that they're going to revisit the inaccessible place. Because sometimes you have people who are bringing claims against hotels when they're traveling and they can't show they're going to come back, or against the hospital that they go to and they can't prove that they're going to get sick again. And so it's sometimes difficult for plaintiffs to bring cases under Title III because of the standing requirement. And if you look at the next slide, we've got some cases that show where plaintiffs were successful. The Walker case is somebody who was sued a shopping center for lack of accessibility, and they claimed that he didn't have legal standing because there was a shopping center that was closer to his house, and he couldn't prove that he would go back to the shopping center, and the court said that that was not appropriate, that it wasn't that far away, and he had shopped at this place before, and it wasn't like someplace across the country where it was unlikely he would be harmed in the future if they remained inaccessible. So he won on that. They also raised in that case that you had to exhaust administrative remedies and file with the local entity before filing in court, and the court rejected that, that you don't have to exhaust administrative remedies under Title III. And then on the next case another standing case involving wheelchair users who are looking to access the courts. There is a typo in this slide. It's not the Northern District of Illinois. It's the Northern District of Indiana in this case. Sorry about that. But they were able to prove that they had standing to pursue their claims of inaccessible courts because they did have a case that was pending in the court unrelated to their accessibility claims. There were actually three plaintiffs, and two of them had a pending case and one didn't. And the court said the two that did have a pending case could move forward with their case. And then just the last slide is just some upcoming topics that we think we'll look for in the future. Alan talked about reassignment and employment, as well as the pre-employment testing, and oftentimes that will involve personality testing. We've also got some recent EEOC guidance on arrest and conviction records. There's also been some potential issues regarding medical disclosures on professional license applications that we talked about, the flagging. We also have the new Title III regulations that have come out and how the courts are going to be interpreting those. We've already started to see a little bit of that with the Segway case we referenced, as well as some issues regarding people from post-secondary institutions expelling students who seek mental health treatment or who maybe are committing suicide and being not appropriate to stay in the school. And then we talked about movie theaters, but we're also seeing potential cases involving audio description and closed captioning for people attending live theaters. With that, we've got some resources on the next slide. The ADA National Network, as well as our PNA National Network. And then moving on to the next slide, you have the web links for the Department of Justice, the Job Accommodation Network, and the EEOC. And then just the last slide before we open up for questions, just as Alan said, is that this, if you are an Illinois attorney, you're eligible for 1.5 hours of continuing legal education credit. You just need to send me an email at barryt@equipforclawney.org, and you can get that that credit. So, Claudia, if there's any questions in the remaining time, we're happy to answer those.
Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question or a comment at this time, please press the star, then the one key on your touch-tone telephone.
Okay, operator, do we have any questions on the telephone?
No, I'm not showing any questions on the phone line.
Okay. And for those participants in the webinar room, I also want to remind them to put their questions in the chat area.
I mean, this is Kevin, the operator. We do have one person that queued up on the phone line. Our question comes from Julie Shaw.
Yes, I was wondering, tell me, John. My name is John. I'm with Disability Solutions in Daytona, Florida. And I was just wondering, in regards to the Taco Bell case, what were some of the main pointers in that? Was it more of accessible bathrooms? Is that more what the lawsuit contained?
You know, there's a lot of different things. Let me just, Alan, if you can find that slide.
Yeah.
I know that there was accessible bathrooms as part of it. There was also issues regarding the actual store accessibility. Shoot. There was store accessibility. There was parking accessibility. There was also an issue regarding the queues themselves. So as far as how people lined up in the Taco Bells, that was problematic. And I apologize for trying to find that slide because I've got in my notes. Let's see. Inaccessible parking and signage. There was the door forces. The doors were too heavy. The queue lines. There was counter height issues as far as getting drink lids, I remember. Which was the access to self-service items that's listed there, and then the accessibility of the restroom. So it was really, you know, from entering and parking at the store and then everything within the store, including the restrooms.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
You know, I'm not showing any further questions at this time.
Okay. Well, for the my participants, you can put your questions or comments in the chat area. I do see a comment, and I believe they're asking about the captioning or transcript for today's session. And just wanted to remind everyone that today's session is being recorded, and that includes the captioning that is in the session that will all be provided and archived on our site after the session. Operator, do we have any other questions in the line?
No, I'm not showing any other questions.
One thing I was going to mention, Claudia, is that I think Alan alluded to this at the beginning, but we are going to have a session, a more in-depth session. I know sometimes it feels like we're covering a lot of information in a short period of time. We are going to have, under the legal webinar series, which is on the ADA Great Lakes website, in January, we're going to be having a session called the Top 12 ADA Cases of 2012. And so we're going to be looking more in depth at 12 cases that we think are the most important that have been decided, subjective of course, but and some of them may be some of the cases we talked about today, but really going into the sort of legal arguments and analysis. So if you're interested in that, just go to the Great Lakes ADA website to sign up, and we're also going to be doing a session on the ADA Amendments Act and cases that have been decided since then, as well as litigation arising in the context of the hospitality industry, so accessibility to restaurants and accessibility to hotels and that sort of thing.
Okay. I do see the comments in the chat area regarding the Lane and Kitzhaber case, and the question is, what's the plaintiff's goal that the money currently paying for the segregated workshop be diverted to services for supported employment? And this is on slide 50.
Yeah, I think, and I would need to look at the complaint for sure as far as what's in the request for relief, but my understanding is that what they're looking for is the state to really provide meaningful choice for people, and that right now the way the system is funded, the significant majority of the funding is provided for people in the sheltered workshops, and so they're looking for people to have more meaningful choice, which would mean funding that would allow people to choose supported employment and other types of integrated employment, as opposed to the for many people the only choice of sheltered workshops.
Okay, operator, do we have any questions on the phone line?
No, there are no questions.
Okay. We're actually at the bottom of the hour. Do you want to do any closing comments, Alan and Barry, before we wrap up today's session?
I don't think I have anything. Just thanks to everyone for participating.
Yeah, and I mean, I think one thing to remember is that we sort of are doing a snapshot of some of the litigation that's come out this last year, and we can't get into all the cases, and so it's important to remember that sometimes cases, because of where they're filed, the jurisdiction that they're filed may have a different result than in other jurisdictions, or the facts may sort of turn. So what we're trying to do is give you a sense of what the courts are saying, but that these cases themselves aren't definitive of all the different court cases on these issues, because there are so many decisions that have been coming down. So hopefully we've given a snapshot, but they're not an indication of all the cases that are out there.
Okay. And just to remind everyone that our next session for the ADA Auto Conference is December 18th. This is on ADA and GINA. It's understanding the rules when employers request medical or genetic information. You can register for that session on our website at ada-audio.org. Or if you need assistance, you can call 877-232-1990. And if your question or comment did not get addressed today, or if you think of something later, you can call your regional ADA center at 800-949-4232. Today's session was recorded, and it will be archived on our website in 7 to 10 business days from today. That will include a copy of the transcript and a copy of the presentation. Mm-hmm. Have a light. with that, to thank Barry and Ellen for today's presentation, and we will conclude today's session.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's presentation. You may now disconnect and have a wonderful day.